of man appearing in the record of the parade of life. So, man, the last 2 hours, and modern man, as we know him, the last 5 minutes, the last 5 minutes of a year of time. So when you put it in this perspective, you see, man, if we give him 5 minutes of this year, this means 50,000 years. 50,000 years. Well, we don't know much about culture or anything else. It goes back more than 50,000 years, even in terms of stone tools and so on. So you can get some idea of the perspective of this in terms of time. Fossils, yes, a fossil record going back 40 days. Man's record going back 2 hours. You see. So that this places the perspective. Now, what we want to do is to follow through the geologic sequence and see now how the mountain building and the processes that relate to our particular area here came into being, and the background in which it happened. So let's refer now to some maps, and I'm going to give you just a kind of a run through of the highlights of this development, and we're going to pay particular attention to the area where we are, which is right here in north central Washington at this point. Now, this map that I'm going to use is a geologic map of North America. And being a geologic map, it shows the ages of the various rock formations that are present at the surface of the earth throughout all of North America. And they relate, the ages relate to this chart of geologic time I have over here, so that we find that all of the Proterozoic and Archaeozoic rocks, which we call the Precambrian rock, are all colored one color, or one shading of a color. So let me show you where these rocks outcrop. Now, these are the oldest rocks that we have recorded in the North American continent. And you can see this color pattern, I think, from where you sit. Notice that all the rocks in this area are colored the same color, clear up in here to the southern part of Greenland, and all around here. Now, there are a few other places where we find rocks of this color, in the core of the Appalachian Mountains, down through here, just a narrow sliver of these rocks. Over in the Grand Canyon area, there's just a little sliver. In the core of the Rocky Mountains, we find a sliver of these old rocks. And this ties into what I told you yesterday, that mainly these older rocks are covered up by younger rocks. The younger rocks relating to the successive periods over here. And to complete this, perhaps we should just finish this out. We have the Archaeozoic, Proterozoic, and some of your notes will show the Paleozoic would be all of these, and the Mesozoic, and then the Cenozoic up here. Now, we have these five major chapters comprising all of geologic time, and these are the subdivision and the corresponding rocks. Each have colors on this map. So now let's look at the oldest rocks of the North American continent. They are in the Canadian Shield area. And the Canadian Shield includes everything from the Great Lakes here, clear on north, and up into and including a part of Greenland. This was the nucleus of the North American continent to start with. Now, we want to follow the sequence of development of the North American continent until we get out here. At this point, you see Washington and Oregon and all of this area was completely underwater and not a part of the North American continent at all, because it didn't exist as a land area at that time.
This is the old part of North America, and many of you live in this part of the country, northern Minnesota, and so on. You live on the old part of North America. North America has grown out and expanded by accretion from this point out. This was where you would have gone 600 million years ago if you went to the mountains. Here is where the mountains were at that time. And great mountain ranges existed there. How do we know? Because the streams running out of those mountains were high velocity streams that carried big boulders like streams do in the Rocky Mountains today. And we find those boulder beds accumulated along the Lake Superior area, and you can go along and examine many of these in different places. This is how the geologist works out the sequence. Well, the mountains of this area then, more than 600 million years ago, gave rise to sediments. As the streams eroded these mountains, carried them down to lower levels, and deposited them. And what happened next that we want to highlight was that there was a great trough that occurred within the Earth's crust here that received many of these sediments. Now, why is it concentrated along this edge and along this particular part? Here we better digress for just a moment to just represent the edge of a continental area, and we'll come out across the slope and then down into the ocean basin proper. Now, let's put the sea in at, say, roughly this point. Now, here are the mountainous areas. Now, erosion bringing this material down. Let's assume that this material gets carried down and it begins to deposit in here. Now, what's going to happen when we take all of this material here and transport it by stream erosion and put it on the crust of the earth here? The tendency is going to be for this to push down. The tendency over here is going to be for this to tend to rise because the load is being relieved. And the crust tends to respond to these major adjustments, which occur very slowly over long periods of time. So what happens here, the floor doesn't stay like this. It begins to form like this. And this, a layer of sediment fills this in. It levels over, and it accumulates more, and as this continues to build in, it depresses further, and so we get this kind of a depression going on. Now, what causes this is still under debate, and the geophysicists and so on are still working with this kind of adjustment of the Earth's crust. That it does happen, there is no doubt. But why it happens is still subject to some question. One of the great concepts is, and I mentioned this yesterday briefly, that we have major convection currents in the Earth's crust. And if these major convection currents, you see, produce like this, then there is a tendency to shear under, and so this material tends to get sheared under the continent in this way. See, I'm exaggerating here, but you get the picture. That this trough now begins to form, and it's also drawn down by this convection current, which opposes, really, another one over here that's going this way. So you see, near the margins of the continents, we get this kind of a shearing under. And maybe the continents can be likened just to a floating ice cake, where you have convection currents coming under them from both sides. North America, with convection currents coming under this way, going in like that, and over on this side, the convection currents are coming shearing under this way, and North America itself is simply a big block of the Earth's crust with convection currents coming under on each side. Well, there is certain evidence for this, and from earthquake shocks and the kind of things that we talked about yesterday in general. whatever the cost, that's just dropping, whether it's just by loading, and simply, if you can understand, if you pile on material, it tends to sink. And if you remove material, it tends to rise. So this material now gets down deep within the Earth's crust again. And you know, as you go down, if you drill a well 1,000 feet deep, the temperature is higher at the bottom of the hole than it is at the top. There's a general increase in temperature corresponding to about 1 degree to every 100 feet you go down. So now as you go down, the temperature rises. This produces chemical action, you see. And as the water and the sediments and so on are depressed, and finally you build up enough heat and enough activity that you can generate new magma, or you see, you liquefy the rocks. Then material way down in the bottom here becomes a liquid, and under pressure from both sides, this is greatly exaggerated, but you do have pressures from both sides, whether you visualize this as currents or what. And the weakest link would be where you had these newly deposited soft sediments. So these would tend to get squeezed. And as they get squeezed, they began to recrystallize and form the kinds of rocks that we have in this area. We call those metamorphic rocks. So that if we had ordinary limestone, involved in this kind of squeezing, it would form marble. And if we have shale, in this kind of squeezing and recrystallization, the shale becomes slate. And if we have sand, or sandstone, this becomes quartzite. Now, if we further metamorphose, if we mix these so that we have some sand and clay, we get schist. And we can also get gneiss. G-N-E-I-S-S. Now, these are the kinds of rocks that we have here. Now, they were once sedimentary beds, but they now are marbles, and we can go up to the mine level where they've tunneled in to the mountain and brought out fresh rock, and you can go up there and find good samples of marble, slate, quartzite, schist, and gneiss. And the other material you find is the material that tends to rise as it becomes liquid. This material becomes the granite, and the other common materials that we have here are diorite and basalt. Now, all of these were liquid and formed from liquid rocks. And we find all of these here. So if you go up on the mine tailor, you can find basalt, you can find diorite, and you can find granite. So that we have these in the Cascade Mountains, and we have them in other mountains as well. So now let's go back and look at the sequence and pick this up. We have to review this first in order to understand what's going to happen first in North America in this trough, which we call the Appalachian Trough. Now, this trough began to form at this point in time, 600 million years ago, roughly. And it continued to exist as a trough for 350 million years, roughly. And so from 650 million years, you see, on until it took that much time for this flooded area to be filled up with sediments, mainly from here, you see, with materials carried in here. Now, there is a counterpart to this over in here. And I'm not going to talk about it except to mention it, so that you will understand that the sediments didn't all come this way, they went both ways. There's a trough that's buried out in here, and it's not evident. It's the ancestral trough that accumulated a great deal of sediment, which later became involved in the building of later mountain ranges. But the Appalachian trough now, which we can see plainly on the map, is this old trough. And so the North American continent now, having this trough along its side, gradually filled up. And the trough actually got essentially level full at this point. Now, it's when this trough got pretty level full, you see, that the water areas began to be restricted in this particular part of the area. And here's where we get a very natural development in life, that the fish, you see, gradually change to land forms by a by actually converting to lungs, you see, that they where they could breathe air and being able to stay on the land, so that we get a transition here in life. And the amphibians became much more dominant in the latter part of this period, along with a lot of insects and a lot of vegetation of various kinds, because as we get more land now and less sea, we change from a marine environment to more of a terrestrial kind of an environment. Now, those of you who know the eastern part of the country also know that this is the area where we have all the coal beds. Now, the coal beds are right in here, in this general area, and also throughout, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and this general area. When the trough got level full, so that there was just a minor, it was a swampy area, this was a time for great accumulation of vegetation. And the vegetation got buried, and the mud washed over it and kept it from decaying and rotting. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had any coal, you see, because we have to preserve the material without oxidizing. Because if you oxidize the plants, then there's nothing left. The plants that fall on the ground out here in the winter, you see, completely oxidized by the next summer, and they're destroyed. And you can't burn that, doesn't make coal or anything else. But in the swamps of the Everglades and other places, the vegetation is still accumulating today as it did in the past. And we get this kind of situation geologically, where you have very swampy areas with a lot of the vegetation accumulating and coal beds forming in great thicknesses. Well, this happened as this trough filled up, and then the cycle comes to an end when we get mountain building involved, where it becomes all land area and keeps on being squeezed until it's thrown into big folds and faults, and the rocks are changed to from the limestones to marbles and so on. And then, you see, we come to a mountain building period. Now, in contrast to a sediment receiving period. So this ends a cycle, and when this cycle ends and the mountains are built and the rocks are changed and become hard, and then the North American continent is increased in size from this area here, which was the margin, now to this area, which becomes the outer margin of the North American continent along here. And it also extended across here. You can see that there's a buried link, and then it ties across to the Ozarks over here, and across here, and then it's buried out in here. But the North American continent at this point was about this size. Didn't include any of this area over here. At that time, the beds that the oldest remnants of beds that we have are marine beds in this area, representing the marble, the slate, and the quartzite, and so on. These were deposited in this period of time here. And this goes back about 400 million years ago. So that the rocks that you're looking at, Martin Ridge, and Buckskin Mountain, and so on, are these kinds of formations which were being deposited in the sea here 400 million years ago until, say, 250 million years ago or so in at this particular time. Then, when this big mountain period came to an end, now we start a new cycle of erosion. And now these mountains become eroded. And the mountains that existed over in here also become eroded. And they give rise to new troughs which form in this area. Well, the next most important thing that happens, we'll skip over some parts of this now and come to the part that relates to us directly. The next most important thing that happens is that in this period of time, in the Jurassic here, we have an uplift of an area down in here. This is the Sierra Nevada range and the Cascade range coming right up through here. So the northern end of the Cascades is just a little ways into Canada. And so from here, clear down to here, we have more than 1,100 miles of a mountainous chain that came up about 150 million years ago. And on each side of this, there was a trough, one out here and another one in here. Now, sediments from the old mountain building period in here and this newly formed landmass of the Sierra Cascades, which was an uplift and came above the level of the sea, then began to deposit sediments in this area and also began to expose to erosion the rocks that had been formed in Washington here during the previous millions of years. Now, what do we see as we look here in our own valley? On Martin Ridge, the beds are sitting, if you can just visualize, Martin Ridge is right out here. And if you go out and look, you can see that the grain of the bed are like this. Now, back on this side, to my right, over here, as you go down the road to the lake, you find granites instead of quartzites, marbles, and slates. Down there you find granites. Now what happened? This big granite mass, 150 million years ago, roughly, called the Chelan batholith, a Chelan granite mass that was intruded in the area of Chelan. And it pushed up. Here it is, coming up. And it pushes these beds up. And this great granite mass was intruded into this area. And you go down the road here, you get about two-thirds of the way down. You begin to see granite along the side of the road, just good gray granite that you're all familiar with. And you can follow this kind of thing all the way to Chelan. And it includes a great big area here where this great big blob of liquid material was literally forced up into this area and tipped all of these beds at a high angle. And angles now that are 65 to 85 degrees from the vertical, you see, and dipping very sharply. Well, in this process, this is the ancestral Cascade mountain building period. It goes back 150 million years. Now, these mountains, when they were pushed up, became again the source of new sediments. And the new sediments were deposited from the mountains out into troughs on both sides of the Cascade area and contributed to the big trough that formed in the area, which is now the Rocky Mountains. So the Rocky Mountain area, which goes all the way from here, you see, right down through here, this is the Black Hills. Here is the area in Idaho and Wyoming, going clear on down here, and down like this through Colorado, then tying to a chain of mountains that goes all the way through Central America and includes the Andes Mountains, you see, of South America. So now we have a trough. This was a trough. And again, a great trough that kept sinking for millions of years and accepting sediment as it sank. And finally it came to a swampy condition, very swampy area in late or in Cretaceous time, at the time when we had these tremendous dinosaurs. This was a time when across this area, and perhaps even out into this part of the country, we had swampy conditions and conditions of flat land where these tremendous beasts could partly be suspended in water and just kind of buoyed themselves up, and like was mentioned this morning, Brontosaurus, you see, they had to put him in the ark. He was 80 feet, 100 feet long, and would stand almost again as high as this roof. That is 40 feet high. I don't know just how high this is, but 40 feet high, 120 feet long, the longest ones. Well, tremendous animals, and many others, not so large, but still exceedingly large animals. Little bitsy brains, size of your fist, control that much animal. And he had a brain in front and one behind, one to run his front legs and one to run the back ones, and just a kind of a cord between, you see. And really, there isn't much difference in the size of it. So, this was the world of Brahm. Well, fortunately, that came to an end. Now, the next thing that happens, that is the sequence now, after the accumulation of this great amount of sediment in the Rocky Mountain trough, then it finally gets full too. Now, we get a swampy condition again, and more coal. And you know, we have a lot of coal out in this area. And there are great beds of coal, thicknesses up to 50, 60, 70 feet thick in places where the coal has accumulated. And it's a poor grade of coal because it hasn't seasoned so long as the coal back in this part of the country, which is much older. And so it isn't of such high commercial value, but nevertheless, lots of coal repeating the same situation that we had over here only millions and millions of years later, you see, representing a different seed and the culmination of the seeds in this particular area. Now, it's at this time when the dinosaurs and the coal and so on form in this part of the country, and during this time now, again, the Cascades here, right where we are, were no doubt under the level of the sea at this particular time, at least swampy and probably marine deposits. So that all of this mountain range that we had built up got leveled off by erosion, completely leveled off. And we find that it was greatly weathered and eroded and made so that all these folds were simply cut off to a common level and buried below sediments again. Now, how do we know this? If we want to find this out, you can't find it out here because all of this material has since been uplifted and removed. But we find it on the flanks of the Cascades down near Wenatchee, and you don't have to get very far out from the Cascades, a little ways out into here, where you can drill wells and dig down through the surface materials and find these older beds. And we find them farther out in the Columbia Plateau and along the margins of the mountain. If you're going to study the history of a mountain range, you can't go to the center of the mountain range where we now are, because the material, so much of it, has been removed from the center, and the record is really off on the flanks. This is where the roots are, you see. And you have to study it all the way back in order to really understand when and how it happened. So, this area received sediments during that time. Now, we'll come up to, see, we had this important mountain building event here, 150 million years ago, as of this time. Now, at this point, the Rocky Mountains form here. Now we find that during the Cenozoic, this area received sediments again, but one of the most important things that happened in this area was the outpouring of lava in this particular area. This is the time now when volcanic activity played a very important role in the geology of this particular area. Because if you notice on this map, look at this color. You can see this color and this color. Notice how they cross this area. Again, you can see it on this map, which is a smaller scale, but notice it here. All of this color here represents the outpouring of tremendous quantities of lava, making the Columbia Plateau one of the greatest accumulations of volcanic rocks at the surface of the earth that we know. The others being in India and to some degree in South America. But this great Columbia Plateau, over 200,000 square miles in area, and much of it, as you know, when you drive into Grand Coulee and other places, you can see thicknesses in the canyon wall of 2,000 to 3,000 feet of this stuff. Just sharpen your pencil and calculate the volume. 200,000 square miles covered by thicknesses of a half a mile to, you see, a great deal more, 2,000 to 3,000 feet in thickness. It's a tremendous amount. Where did it all come from? Well, it had to come from down within the earth, and it was extruded out on the surface and formed these plains. Not all of it just flowed out. Some of it formed mountains, like our mountain Glacier Peak, which was a volcanic peak. And others formed simply by big cracks opening up. And this liquid material squeezed out, you see, when this particular area was subjected to this kind of diastrophism or mountain building. Now, the kind of rock that we have across the Columbia Plateau is basalt. It's black and it's dense and it's very hard. The kind of rock that we had involved in the Chelan batholith, you remember, was granite. Now, we also have another kind that's very important in this area called diorite. Now, diorite, you can just remember this, is just, it's just a kind of an intermediate kind of rock. It isn't the white, nice, lighter weight rock such as granite is, and it isn't the heavy black rock of basalt, but it's just halfway in between. And this was intruded into this area, as well as the basalt, at various times within this sequence of time. Probably mainly about this period, which was, say, 25 million years ago to 15 million years ago. So we had these kinds of intrusions. Why do I mention it as being important? Because this is when probably the major part of the ore-bearing solutions that produced the mine across the creek came in. These are the leftover materials after the rock crystallized to form diorite and basalt. What was left over, the juices that were rich in copper and silver and gold and sulfur and various trace elements, even uranium, you see. These things were left over at the end of the crystallization of the rock. And where the rock was broken, as it was over here in the mine area, we had a fracture zone related to, again, this mountain building disturbance of these hard rocks. And where there were fractures that developed in these rocks, these juices found an outlet and found a way into them. And the copper, fortunately for us, got concentrated in Copper Mountain and got concentrated along one of these zones. And there was breakage in the crust and there was a fracturing. And into these fractures and breaks came this material, along with diorite and basalt. And when you go up on the tailings of the mine, we can find these. When you go in the mine, you can see them. And the geologists mapped them, and the ore body was related to these intrusions of this kind of material. Okay, now we're up to, say, 15 million years ago. And this sort of thing has happened. And the cascades now as a result of this activity, volcanic activity from below, got uplifted. These ancient mountains and their roots were literally lifted up by several hundreds of feet, probably several thousands of feet, so that the Cascades were again exposed to erosion. And the sediments were stripped back, some of the volcanics were stripped back, and the streams began to cut valleys into the old mountain block. And as the streams then etched their way down and carried off the material again, developing valleys, then the next thing that happens that is very significant is that the climatic conditions changed. Now we're up to this point, the Pleistocene and the recent. And this represents the last million years, roughly. This is the age of man. This is when man comes on the scene. And also tied up with his history is the history of the glaciers and the glaciation in this area. Man, no doubt, migrated to this area from other areas, probably from Africa and Asia, via land bridges, you see. And we find him, along with other animals, many of which are now extinct and not living at all, the woolly mammoth and the mastodon and this kind of animal, the big beavers, big bisons, the Irish elk, and a host of big mammals that lived along with man in the early stages and in the development of the glacial period. Now, what happened in the glacial period was this. North America now has grown, you see, by steps through mountain building movements until we have the present outline, you see, clear out here, and North America is complete as far as its physical development and size is concerned, and the glaciation now may be related in part to the fact that we have such a large land area here and to the fact that it stands relatively high. You know, you find the glaciers in the mountainous areas where they where it's considerably above sea level. Down around sea level, the temperature is very moderate. But this area, again, was stood relatively high, probably. Climatic change, many things might have caused it. We don't know what really caused it. Could have been sunspots, could have been something that changed as far as the energy coming from the sun, you see, being cut out, either by dust clouds or sunspots, or a change in the atmosphere again to include some carbon dioxide. If we had a lot more carbon dioxide, this serves as a shielding material and tends to keep the earth cool. And this could have been a cause for it. Whatever it was, it wasn't a major change, as you might think of. If you just think of it this way, that we could have the glaciers start advancing again from Bonanza Peak up here, if we simply allowed an overall climatic lowering of the temperature about 4 to 5 degrees, that is on the seasonal average. This is all it would take. If you had a general lowering of 4 or 5 degrees, now this isn't very much, but if you applied this to the whole continent and to the ocean areas as well, applied it to the earth, you see, this would be enough to allow snow to accumulate faster than the sun could melt it out in a year's time. So the general net would be an increase in the accumulation of snow. Now, this would go very slowly. It'd begin with maybe a few inches a year. Then gradually it would build up, you see. Now, what causes the glaciers to move once they begin to form? Well, it's simply that as the snow and ice accumulate, If we just put it on an incline, just to illustrate here, and we'll assume now that the snow begins to accumulate up here. Now, we've got a permanent snow field at this point. Now, if we add another increment to this, the next year, you see, and the next year, and down at this end, it's always melting out, you see. It tends to melt out at the lower end and accumulate more in the upper end. Now, when you get to a critical stage of piling on here, this is the same thing that happens, you see, in the Earth's crust, except that here now we're dealing with snow and ice. And this is much more pliable and more plastic. So, as this piles on and the weight increases, it gradually forces movement along here. Now, as this next snowfall accumulates and more accumulates, you can see that this gradually advances down the valley until now we get ice and snow then accumulating to where this part of the glacier is mainly snow. This is a transition kind of material, and this is solid glacial ice. And it moves down like this, you see, and carries everything with it. And what does it do to this? Wherever the rocks are fractured or in any way made so it can be picked up, this block here, you see, is picked up. It gets into here, and it's carried on down. And so it quarries out the bottom. So we find that the glacier tends to cut in like this. Now, you can see that the ice still keeps moving material out. And so here's a situation where you can develop a situation like we have at Heart Lake. Now, when you go up the valley to Heart Lake, the first thing you observe is the falls now, this side of Heart Lake. Why are they there? Well, simply because right at this point, there's a ridge. Do you remember that ridge? Now, this ridge is a particular kind of rock. And it's harder than the rock on this side, and it's harder than the rock on this side. So now, visualize the glacier all melted out in this particular valley. And the situation you have is this. Here's Heart Lake, back here. Here's Heart Falls. Railroad Creek comes on down this valley. Now, this same kind of thing, you see, has gone on in each of these valleys that were formed in the Cascade Mountain area. Now, look at it on the North American continent. What happened back in your area in Minnesota or wherever you live? A great ice mass, a continental ice mass, began to form in the Hudson Bay area. In general, in here, there were different centers that formed, and they coalesced. And the ice moved down across the plains from the north to the south. How far did it go? It went as far as it could until it melted out, you see, and finally it melted out on the lower edge. Down farther south it got, the more melting occurred. And so we know now that it covered Iowa. It pretty well came right down along the river here, you see. It came down to about that point, just like this. And extends over into here. Now, when we get over to this part of the United States, the continental ice mass was a solid sheet of ice up in here. And when it got to northern Washington, here we have the ice breaking down into canyons. So they were like the Chelan, the ice that came down the Chelan lake or valley area. This ice mass was a solid, well, you shouldn't call it a river of ice, but a solid block of ice and that was moving through this valley was 80 miles long. One ribbon of ice. 80 miles long, moving gradually from the upper area in here down by gravity, you see, and down far enough south until it finally melted out around the city of Chelan. Now you can see this much better when you look over in here on the larger map of the geologic map of Washington. I've left this up here so that you can have a look at it. And here it is. It started way up in here, and Railroad Canyon, you see, contributed all of its ice to that glacier, as did all the other canyons that came in to the Lake Chelan trough. And the whole thing moved down as a solid mass, carrying rock with it all the way down to the city of Chelan.
Some of these areas that we've been talking about, if the snow kept coming and building up, what forced it to move?
Okay, let's just look at a perfectly flat area. We'll just draw it as flat as we can. Let's assume that snow begins here. Now, if this continues to grow until you get a pile like this, here again, you get this bottom squeezed out, and actually you get flowage both ways. Now, if you form this in to the north here in the Hudson Bay area, it wouldn't tend to melt out to the north, but it would to the south. See? So one of these areas becomes rather ineffective, and the other becomes rather prominent. And so now the ice tends to move this way until we get it coming down like this. Now, there's another phenomenon that occurs here. Once you get an ice field started, then you see the air currents that come in, carrying moisture, get elevated and cool. And so you get most of the precipitation along the leading edge of the ice mass that's forming. So most of the snow forms back in here. And back in here, very little snow. What do you find when you go to Antarctica? We have the driest desert that we know any place in the world, right in the middle of this tremendous ice mass that covers Antarctica. All of the snow falls around the edge. And so now, as it accumulates here, it moves out. And it accumulates here, and it moves out. And it keeps moving. You see, it tends to perpetuate itself. The leading edge becomes the main area of accumulation. And accumulation is all you have to get weight. And the weight is all you need to cause movement. Now, and you see, man can simply ride over small mountains and valleys and so on, and it came all the way across Iowa and Illinois and so on, because the ice was thick enough. How thick was it? A couple of miles thick. We think from 5 to 10,000 feet thick over most of those states. Now, that's thick enough, you see, that any little irregularities in the topography don't really matter. And it simply rides over hills and valleys alike and works its way south until it finally melts up. Well, the glacial story in the Cascades is the one that provides the frosting, really, in many ways, from a point of view of scenery in here. What do we have in these valleys? They start out as, let's look at, we start out as roughly with the valleys being stream valleys, having this kind of a profile with the stream being down on the bottom here. Now, these were actively being eroded, you see, at the time the ice began to advance. The ice fills in here now, and it cuts out these sides like this, so that we get this shape to the valley. Now, you see, the valley, instead of being V-shaped, becomes U-shaped on the bottom. Because the ice moving through here, you see, erodes and cuts away and transports away the valley wall and rasps off and grinds off the bottom just like a big sanding block until you get this kind of a profile. Now, you get the name of the Cascade Mountains for the simple reason that the stream that runs down this slope, wherever it comes from, comes cascading over here and down. So we get waterfalls and cascades, you see, that are related to glaciation, to the oversteepening
of the valley wall.
Normally this stream, you see, had this profile and so on over here. But now you see it comes here and it has a sharp break in its profile and it cascades. So at Hard Lake or all of the falls that come into Railroad Canyon, come in, drop over these steep canyon walls. And if you go into the next canyon, either direction from here, you'll find the same situation. All related to glaciation. Because you see now, you have a different kind of erosion. The erosion is produced by the ice that's moving down through the bottom of the valley. Not by the just by the water that's carrying things down the slope. So when you carry things down the slope, it keeps a uniform profile, clear down to the bottom of the stream. You don't find any of these streams in the Middle West. You see, we don't have cascades and waterfalls until you come to some odd situation like you have at Niagara Falls, which is a little different situation. But even that has some relationship to glaciation. But here, everywhere you look, you have this sort of thing. Well, now supposing we just carry this on a little further. I'm going to run out of blackboard in here, but we'll foreshorten it a little. Supposing we have this situation, and we have a U-shaped canyon developing over here now. Now, gradually, you see, as these canyons work on the ridges and work in this direction, you see, and as this expands, and this expands, you see, you get this sort of thing happening. And actually, you sharpen up, you see, cirques eat into these points. And we get sharp peaks that begin to develop as a result of the glacial erosion gradually reducing the divides between the canyons. And so you get a very sharp canyon, you get up on top, and then you get a level here, you get a level over here, and these levels tend to be roughly at the same elevation. Why? Going way back in the history of the mountains to the time when these old eroded mountains were all reduced to a common level, you see. And these rocks up here extended up here, and actually we had an old erosion surface. And about 15 million years ago, that whole mountain block came up. Then the stream started to cut into it. So that this old surface now represents the tops of the peaks in this area, which are mainly the ridges between the valleys. And so when you get up to Cloudy Pass and look across the area, you see this old flat surface, which was produced millions of years ago, but is now, we speak of it as being exhumed. It's simply uncovered. That's a hard word for meaning uncovered. And the old surface has simply been uncovered. And this is what represents the common level of the peaks in our area. And it's also interesting that this upper surface kind of spoils this area from the point of view of mountaineering. Because wherever we have a patch of it left, let's just restore this to where we can look at it a little bit. But let's make it flat here now and say we have this patch left. We find that it's weathered by normal chemical processes of breaking down the minerals, and that this is rotten rock. This is rotten rock. Well, now if you reduce this to a peak, so let's remove all except just a mountain peak here. Let's say now we have a nice jagged peak that's like this, and we'll just make it almost a point. Now, you find nice hard rock till you get up to about here. See, the point at which you really have to climb to get to the very pinnacle. And so, as you follow these, you get good, clean rock where the glacier has removed it and scraped it clean. Then when you get to the very top, and you're ready to go right up on the peak, you find nothing to hold on to. And Of course, you drop off here pretty fast in many of these, and it isn't very safe. So this isn't a real good mountaineering area. Now, Bonanza is a pretty good climbing peak for the reason that it's had so many glaciers on it, all around it, that all this rotten rock is pretty well stripped off. And the glacier has sharpened it up to the point that most of it is pretty climbable. But you go on Martin Ridge, just across, and you can get up to the top 40 or 50 feet, and there's nothing to hang on to. And for every step you go up, you're liable to take a scoot on a rock and go all the way down. So you have to be careful. And this is true of many of the mountains in this area. And so there are only certain ones that you'll find the mountaineers come in here, but they're very selective about which ones they climb. Even Buckskin is not really a very safe climb in many ways, because when you get to the top, right up to the point, you know, then everything gets loose. Things are nice and solid till you get up to where you really, where it gets critical, and then then you don't have anything to hold on to, and that's a poor place to be, you see. You know, they're just sky hooks. So, now, I think our time is essentially up. Now, what haven't I covered that you want to hear about? Yeah?
What is the name of the rock that is the primeval rock that you talk about in the Canadian Shield?
In the Canadian Shield. Interestingly enough, it's these metamorphic rocks that I had listed here. Gneisses, schists, and quartzites, and marbles, and all of the same kinds of rock pretty much that we have here now, formed at a much earlier period, but formed in the same kind of a process, and again intruded with lots of granites, and you know, there are many granites and crystalline rocks of this kind that are also a part of that area. Really, the rocks are not too different from the kinds of rocks that we have right here.
But which I was for an earlier cycle prior to the Iazoic period.
Right, right. So even way back in here, we just lose our history because it becomes so complex that we can't unscramble it. And the other problem is that we have no fossils to work with back in there. And so we have no way of dating. The only way we have of actually dating the sequences back in here is by uranium-lead ratios, which we talked about. And we know they're old, but the differences between a half a billion years and a billion years, you see, when you get back in this area, are not enough to really allow us to work out the details. But we're finding out a lot about it, and a lot of study is going on in that area for the simple reason that so many of our metals are tied up in this kind of an area. This is where the main metals come from. As in every continent, there is a nucleus to every continent. In Australia, the same way, as a shield area. And this is where mainly the metals are. And then we get off on the flanks of this, where you have the softer rocks, the sedimentary rocks. This is where then you can find coal, oil, this kind of thing. You find no coal, no oil in that area, that tremendous area. Yes?
Why do you find so many metals in that area?
Because there are so many intrusions of these igneous rocks. Just as there was here on a local basis, you have it on such a grand scale up in here. And these various of these blocks here are intrusions into this old crystalline mass, and it's been stripped down so deep that many of them are exposed right at the surface. As in the case of the Keweenawan Peninsula, where you had tremendous deposits of copper. There you had copper, it was pure copper. The reason you had it was that you had material like this, which weathering secondarily removed the sulfur and removed the iron, and so the copper just accumulated and formed the element just accumulated in this area. As we do the iron ranges you see in Minnesota, again, great accumulation from the erosion, a tremendous amount of erosion of this material and secondary concentration of it in local areas, and this is what you need for an ore. And the ore that they mine up there is simply iron oxide, which was released from the minerals that were in the granites and in the gneisses and the schists of the old rocks in this area, and the tremendous long periods of time of erosion have gradually concentrated these various metal-rich materials.
Why would, maybe this is a stupid question, but I'm real stupid about this. Why would this area have the metals, for instance, in this mountain, and the mountain on this side not have any, or does it have?
Well, if it does have, it's so completely buried that we haven't found any trace of it. Now, we don't know, you see, and we have no very good ways of telling what's back inside of these hills and mountains. Now, we do have instrument help here. The magnetometer, for example, will pick up the presence of anything that's magnetic, and metals usually have a magnetic... there's usually something with
gold.
Gold has no magnetic quality, but it's associated oftentimes with other minerals that do. Now here, the mineral that was magnetic was pyrrhotite. And magnetite, you see, is a very common association, and it's magnetic. So we can use an instrument. This will give us a better chance, you see, of digging into the mountain and finding something if we find a high concentration of magnetism. So they've gone over all of these mountains and ridges with the magnetometer. They've also gone over the areas with a gravity type of instrument, simply meaning that the more dense materials, which is the metal, will have higher mass attraction, and they'll tend to pull. So if you work with this kind of an instrument, you get an idea. And we have other rather sophisticated types of things that give us leads, but nothing really tells you until you dig in. Now, this company dug into Buckskin Mountain because they had at least good leads to cause them to do this, and they dug into the mountain over in Martin Ridge, but they didn't find it. See, they found traces, but they never found a rich enough concentration. Now, copper is a very small percentage of the total elements that we have in the Earth's crust. It's way less than 0.05 or 6, a half a percent. And it's a very low concentration, and so we've got to find places in nature where nature has helped out in the concentration. In this area, it was a primary area where nature, through a fractured zone, allowed for the escape into this fractured area of certain of these rich copper solutions. Now, even these solutions aren't very rich in terms of copper, you see. Only they were working with 2% material, you see, where the total ore was, they had less than 2% copper. And but even that, with the price, allows it to be commercial. Now, if we're in the Keweenaw Peninsula, we got a great start in copper. With copper, that was 100%. Gee, all you had to do was just scoop it up on the surface. It was 100%. And we got our great start in the Industrial Revolution as far as iron was concerned and heavy industry by the great iron deposits in Minnesota and around the Great Lakes area, where nature again had concentrated material from over a vast area down in here. And here we just had the most wonderful iron ore that you could ask for.
Well, many of the metals then are related so that you get the concentration of various metals,
right,
in the given area.
Right. And you go to Africa, and here we have again a great concentration of metals. Because it's a great big shield area. It's very much like Canada.
Another question I'd like to ask, this is not relative to this, but in the stone structure, you mentioned that it was compressing and so on. So is diamonds a portion of that?
Yes, it's related to that, except diamond is a mineral and not a stone in the sense that we look at it. you call it a stone, we call it a mineral, which has a definite chemical formula. But you see, diamond is pure carbon, but there's another form of pure carbon that's the softest material you know, that's graphite. Now the two are both the same, except that under high stress and high compression, you squeeze the atom structure together to such a degree that you get the maximum bonding in diamond, where you get a very loose bonding in graphite. And so while you have the same kinds of materials, one is very soft, the other is the hardest thing we know. Well, that's the bell, and I thank you very much. Now, I think we'll probably have another session tomorrow here, and if we do, this will be a blackboard session, and we're going to talk about the materials of the Earth's crust, what makes up all the lithosphere and so on. Minerals and rocks, and we'll dig out a few samples.